Yes.
Okay, we're back on.
Only one. Later, a marketing man came out, Don Rogers, to handle the customers. And Rogers was, in many respects, a pain in the butt-ski. Because he was a typical American who, if he learned how to say a cup of coffee, that was enough for him. And he was there for 2 years. And that's what he learned how to say.
Okay.
Wow.
He was there. I just came here to sell devices, not to speak this funny language, he says. you've seen guys like that. His wife, on the other hand, and their two kids were of Italian extraction.
Oh, I see.
And all three, especially the kids, learned Italian within a month. And they were so fluent, it was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. They were a big help. They could help. They were particularly useful when we went on trips. And Don Rogers was the driver. So if we went down to Florence, for example, on the Alto Strada, and he was the driver, he knew how to get there. Mm-hmm. He knew, because Don knew everything about Italy within a month after he was there, even though he didn't care for the language or the funny money that they had. We had those big bed sheets at that time.
Oh, right.
10,000 lira notes. Mm-hmm. And he ran a stoplight on the freeway. And a policeman came up alongside. And he stopped the car and he said in Italian to Don, "You ran the light." Mm-hmm. And Don says, "Don't understand. No capisce, no capisce." And his little daughter was sitting in the back seat. She said, "Hey, Dad, he said you ran the stoplight." It was so funny that the policeman laughed. And he said, "Is that what he said?" So, I won't do it again. Tell him I won't do it again. And the policeman laughed. And that's the way the kids were. Very, very outspoken.
Was the SGS effort the first effort to break into a foreign market, like the European market, by establishing some sort of organization in Europe?
In that way, yes. Yeah. It was not the first effort to sell product in Europe,
right,
because we received many orders for product that came from Europe as a result of European contacts at trade fairs and things like that. Mm-hmm. But this was the first organized presence in Europe start.
Did you have any salespeople who were responsible for Europe before that?
Not directly. Not that we had guys on the East Coast who would jump over into France and Italy and England from New York.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And they would sell product there. We also had a lot of inquiries that came as a consequence of these trade shows that came from Europe. And they were handled through the office on the East Coast.
Okay.
So there was enough activity to warrant an investment to satisfy company needs or customer needs directly. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of money to set this up. Mm-hmm. So, and also that if we set it up, we should have with some kind of marketing organization to work with. And SGS, Società Generale Semiconduttori, the Società had two other partners, each of whom had good marketing organizations in Europe.
Okay.
So they took on the marketing in Europe immediately of our product.
Okay.
So whenever stuff came to the United States to be filled, it generally was siphoned through the European organization.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it would end up down in, where we were down in Agrate, and we would ship from there. If it was not the latest, very latest product that we hadn't transferred to manufacture there. We had a sales organization which kept an inventory of all of Fairchild products that they shipped from, but it wasn't all manufactured in.
I see.
Okay.
Now the big problem of SGS was that they were a germanium house.
Okay.
They started out as a germanium company, and they had something like 2 or 3 years worth of unsold inventory. Wow. In germanium. And germanium, as you know, is not a stable product. It doesn't have an oxide. It just goes to pot. And so we had tons of testing and retesting to do in order to make sure we were not sending out defective equipment. We also had the Italians to fight because they did not like the idea of writing off the inventory. So that was an American practice. And I fought like hell to, and succeeded in part only, to write off the inventory. Let's just get it out of there, scrap it, throw it away, give it away, whatever we want to do. But let's start marketing the products that we're making there. And within, we were making Fairchild product within less than 3 months from the time we started. Because you could do the assembly. So you could send the chips over there and assemble them, test them, and then send them out to the customer. We did not set up a diffusion organization until later, until much later. So it was a challenge to get rid of that germanium inventory. Now, there was one product in germanium that sold like hotcakes, and that was point contact diodes. And these were rectifier diodes for radios. Very cheap. They were maybe a penny or two a piece. And that was the germanium was the only thing that could satisfy those specifications. So that one was saleable, but none of the others. They were just passé. Bob Noyce's orders to me were to get this crap out of here as fast as you can. Well, you know, there's another. You got two other partners, and if you're going to scrap it, how do you write it off? And in Italy, you have to choose the right set of books in order to write it off, because their accounting is leaves a little bit to be desired. It's not according to all the rules of the United States. Here we wouldn't hesitate to write it off, take a big loss, and then extend the loss over a period of years. Couldn't do that Italy, not unless you kept more than one set of books, one for write-off and one for, for sale. So technologically, it was a good venture. The Italians learned quickly. They had good technical guys. I sent several of them back to the United States to learn to work in Charlie Spork's manufacturing line, so as to get the techniques and the specifications, and then come back and install them in Italy. But that was the easy part of the job. And the hard part was just to convince them that the germanium just wasn't going to be around, and any time we took with it, we'd be wasting. They were so proud of their big germanium lines that you can't tell somebody that's useless if he spent his professional life putting it together. Well, you do it in the States.
Actually, I would have a question. Did SGS precede the agreement with Fairchild, or was it? So I mean, so SGS was a company that existed.
Oh yes, prior SGS, to Società was a combine of two companies.
Okay.
So it was already a Società, society.
Okay.
Fairchild added a third, but it still stayed as a Società.
I see. Okay. Okay.
Right.
So Fairchild took essentially a position in that company?
They took a position in that company, and it amounted to 40% of the ownership.
Okay.
Therefore, when the profits were split, such as they were, they were split 40-30-30.
Okay.
There were a lot of particular problems besides the technological ones. The salespeople of SGS did not want to give up the product. They just simply... They simply had commitments that they had made, and how could you go to a customer and say you can't have what you ordered? I can give you something newer, not quite the same, but that's a hard sell for a novice in sales.
Right.
In the United States, they just would have said, hey, it's no longer around. Here's the catalog. Pick what you want. You know, this kind of thing. It just quite didn't work out. Then there were a lot of customer problems because the germanium was not a reliable product.
Okay.
It died on the shelf. It died in customers' computers. And they just, we had a steady diet of trying to pull back rejects, returns, and retesting them to see if they were any good. And that was just one horrible mess. So out of the 2 years that I spent there, I probably spent a year just trying to get rid of the germanium. We finally accomplished that, but it was a battle all the way.
It was fizzing out the technology, putting a new one. I mean,
it was a major change. Everything not only that, the number of people involved in the silicon assembly at that stage were about half of those involved in the germanium assembly.
I see. Okay.
So we had to release.
Okay.
Now that you don't do in Italy either.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Because they're all members of unions.
Yes.
I mean, governmental unions. It's not just political. It's a governmental organization. And if you have to ask a director to resign, a guy who was, say, in charge of the particular line, the only job you can offer him is as a director someplace else.
Cool.
It's a national lineage. I think France had similar things in those periods, in that period, conceivably.
Yeah.
When you get above the dirigente level, they call it, director's level, a guy who is let go, not his own fault, can only be replaced, can only be given a job elsewhere at the same director's level.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, how do you do that? Here it's easy. You say, there's the door.
Yeah, right.
So we had those kinds of problems. And that was something that we never really had a good fix on when we first started. We probably would have shored up the contract a little bit more heavily. Technologically, they were good. The guys were good. They learned what a silicon planar transistor was and what the integrated circuits were. They were very pleased to be able to market those, and we never could get enough of those because it was a small production line. And there were a number of other problems that were that popped up when you least expect them. I got a letter from Noyce while I was there saying, can you stop for a moment and go to Sweden and talk to a certain customer there. The guy's name, they were in the automobile industry. It was an automobile customer. He's been sending us complaints here in Fairchild that the silicon products, not the ones we were ones we were not yet making, or were not good, and Noyce didn't have anybody to send. So he sent me, because I was from Fairchild, the United States. So I said, hey, Bob, you know, we can't solve it. We can't service the guy from here. He said, no, just keep him happy. We'll send him what he needs from here. But see what you can do to mollify the case for some reason, find out more about it. So Noyce sent him a letter saying that I was coming. Harry Sello of Fairchild is coming to talk with you. We'd be pleased if you would explain to him the problem so he can help you out. We got a fast letter back in Agrate, back in Italy, saying, would you please ask Mr. Sello, not doctor, Mr. Sello, that it won't be necessary for him to come from Italy. Well, there's not much business we do with Southern Italians. Therefore, we would prefer to be serviced directly out of the United States. And he sent a copy of that to Noyce. Noyce called me up and said, hey, what have you done to deserve that? I said, nothing. I have never even heard of the guy. That's their way. They don't do business with Southern Italians. And Sello...
Sello is Southern Italian. I mean, it could be Southern Italian.
It could be Southern Italian. Yeah, it has that Chernihiv kind of thing.
Right.
Yes.
And Noyce had to answer the letter saying, no, this is an American from the United States, well acquainted with the process. He is on temporary duty there, and he will make it his business to get up to your country. Well, it took that to get me up there. And what it was a reliability problem on the then planar transistors, which hadn't met the specification, and they wanted another shipment. But I had to go in under the masquerade of not being a Southern Italian. you know, we don't deal with Southern Italians. I remember I saved that letter here somewhere, but it was it was a surprise then, but not a surprise later. There were a few such incidents. But we did convert the fact, we got rid of all the germanium finally, and we did build a small inventory of planar and MESA transistors, mm-hmm. not the integrated circuits, because those were not yet finished mm-hmm. from Fairchild, mm-hmm. and in turn loose the particular salesman that we had, got another one from mm-hmm. the States in mm-hmm. its place, in his mm-hmm. place. Mm-hmm. And during the time I was there, Gordon Moore came out to visit the factory.
Okay.
So did Charlie Spork and Dick Hodgson, who mm-hmm. was then president mm-hmm. of Fairchild. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, you know, took them around and mm-hmm. Showed them everything that was there. And Dick Hodgson said, "Hey, you must be having an easy time here. You know all the tricks in Italian." I said, "Well, it wasn't easy to come by, you know. I had to. I studied the language, by the way. It uh-huh. It warranted that. I had no problem with it. I didn't have to, but I did. Uh-huh. I took tutorial courses in uh-huh. Uh-huh. in the Italian, and helped me enormously, just enormously." then Hodgson came out and he said, "Well, how do you think they're going to do? Will they be able to handle these new integrated circuits that we?" Uh-huh. Are now making?" And I said, "Well, I don't see any reason why not, as long as they have the proper test equipment mm-hmm. and all the other stuff, which we'll have to supply them." Mm-hmm. Well, so I made up an estimate of how much that would cost mm-hmm. to stock the factory
okay.
with the test equipment required for the integrated circuits. Mm-hmm. And it was a sizable few million dollars of things. Mm-hmm. Well, at that time, unbeknownst to me, SGS, without telling their other partner, they told their Italian partner, SGS had gone ahead and contracted to build two more factories, one in England and one in Germany, on the hope that the silicon devices would fill up those factories and make it all one set of products. However, the cost was enormous, and there was no way we were going to do that at the present level of the operation of SGS. Mm-hmm. We would do it if the partners would ante up more money, because mm-hmm. it was a sizable investment. Mm-hmm. But then the structure would have to be realigned, mm-hmm. and they squawked and weaseled for about 6 months, mm-hmm. and then didn't want to do it. So we elected to pull our investment. Okay. Which means we started from scratch again. After being there, uh-huh. we had to start a whole complete semiconductor operation somewhere else.
Oh my gosh.
Which was quite costly. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to put up with it. They thought they could go ahead and make the planar devices themselves. Mm-hmm. And I pointed out, "You can't do that without a license." Mm-hmm. "Oh, well, we won't tell you. We'll just do it." And they said, "You won't tell us, and we'll find out about it, and it'll cost you."
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So it remained a stalemate, and in 68 mm-hmm. We sold our share in SGS.
Okay.
And we in turn opened a small test and operations unit in England.
In 68?
In 68.
Okay.
And this was, we'd been there 4 years. This was another 3 years after we started. But this one was not dependent on any other owner. Mm-hmm. It was a true Fairchild operation to penetrate the market. So we didn't lose any money on the SGS operation, but we did lose time. Mm-hmm. It was not too effective from that point of view.
When did you did you have a fabrication plant then for the transistors? Did that happen after 68 somewhere?
Yes, they themselves went ahead and they linked up with a company called ATES, A-T-E-S, mm-hmm. which now makes it a third party to take the place of Fairchild.
Okay.
Only this ATES was a branch of RCA Semiconductor.
Oh, I see.
and they made silicon products. So SGS linked up with this Atas firm who was in Sicily and came to join, bringing their licenses from silicon products RCA.
Mm-hmm.
So they ended up working in that field, but at a much, much reduced pace.
Okay.
And we maintained a small operation in England for some years to come.
Okay. And they were manufacturing devices there?
Yes.
Then?
Yeah. Okay. They were not diffusing them.
Mm-hmm.
They were just doing the assemblies.
I see.
Okay. So then SGS could be doing assembly until the 70s or so?
That's right.
I see.
When they got Atis, they then got licenses from this RCA to try to build diffused devices.
Mm.
Okay. So ST Microelectronics was based essentially on RCA processes,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
It was.
Okay.
The basic products were based on.
Okay.
But RCA did not have the integrated circuit line that we had.
Okay.
We would have continued, but SGS got into this nasty habit of building buildings before they had sales.
Yeah.
And we were getting these awful bills for $2 and $3 million every 6 months for a new plant going up someplace else in Europe.
Oh my gosh.
Without the definition of the product to be made there. So all hell broke loose.
Okay. So it means that there was not a great deal of transfer of technology from here to there, right?
No.
Okay.
No,
but
not
really
very much.
Transferring assembly technologies.
Assembly was transferred, and in the small English operation, a small pilot line of diffusion was transferred.
Okay.
A very small one.
Okay.
Just to be able to say that we have, to meet the European requirements on duty and on foreign manufacture. Yeah, that was the big requirement. You couldn't, by that time, the Europeans had learned it. We've got to put a stop to this assembly operation. We want the duty that goes with making the whole product.
Yes.
Oh, and so then by having the line
that's
there.
That's right. So having the line there, we could ship more from the States, but at least we had a line there.
Okay.
Right.
And the English operation lasted for some few years. It was never very big, very good.
And what... was it then closed down in favor of another European operation, or?
Yes, it was closed down in favor of a larger, more broad operation out of Germany.
Okay.
Out of a factory built and purchased in Wiesbaden, Germany.
Oh. Okay.
To be a silicon plant. But now, you have to realize this was already something like 10 years after the introduction of the first silicon devices assembled in Italy.
Okay.
So we lost quite a bit of ground in penetrating the European market, unfortunately. By that time, Motorola and TI had grown considerably. They were making their versions of planar products under our license in England.
Oh, okay. Where they had plants, or where
they had
subsidiaries,
already, yes.
or
France. I mean, SGS moved its operation to France, to the south of France, and joined up with Christoph. You would know if I mentioned
Thompson.
Yes, they became SGST Thompson.
Yes,
right. Thank you, SGS Thompson, and SGS. By that time had developed their own silicon, different than the United States, because they were making a commercial linear products, linear integrated circuits. And they joined in Thompson with that, became a combine of SGS Thompson.
Yeah. And now it's one of the largest companies
in
the world.
And now it's one of the largest companies in the world, yes. They brought in this ex-Motorola guy, the little short guy, I forget his name at the moment, he came in to run the SGS Thompson unit. And of course, Thompson transferred its silicon unit into that one.
Mm. Yeah.
So for them, it was kind of a coalescing of companies.
Yeah.
So in the back in, I guess it must have been 1960 or so, when the initial SGS deal was getting set up, did SGS come and approach Fairchild about the possibility? Or?
Sure, they did. They okay. did, but of course, by that time we had learned that the only way they would get it is if they licensed the process.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we did license SGS to make a line of telecommunications integrated circuits.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. At Agrate, at the place in mm-hmm. In Italy, we did license them to make it, and I wrote a 10-year license for $1 million a year worth of mm-hmm. technology fees, mm-hmm. which wasn't bad. But shortly, not too long thereafter, within the first 4 years or 5 years, they wanted to abrogate the license. They felt no one didn't want to pay the fee anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So they would just go ahead and make it on their own.
Okay.
And we brought suit against them
mm-hmm.
out of Fairchild.
Mm-hmm.
I was the chief testimony
mm-hmm.
on that project
mm-hmm.
because I was the one who knew the process. And I had actually done some work together with SGST
mm-hmm.
in order to start that work.
Okay.
So I was asked to go to the International Arbitration Court in mm-hmm. London mm-hmm. to pursue that litigation
okay.
because SGST did not want to pay the fee.
Hmm.
They claimed that they had it before and all they got was some sort of temporary relief which didn't amount to very much money and they wanted to pull out of it. It was not successful. My testimony was more than they could stand.
So this would have been the late 70s? Or?
Late 70s,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the entry of Fairchild into Europe was later than it could have been if based on a successful entry with the Italians.
Right.
Well, also, at the same time, Gordon Moore came out and he sent me a wire. He said, you've had enough of Italy, we need you back here, we want you back in the States.
Oh, okay.
So that was in about 67 or so, just before they left, before the Fairchild crew left for Intel.
Okay.
They left in 68.
Okay.
So he sent a wire saying he wanted me back because he was now starting a formal R&D organization
mm-hmm.
for Fairchild in Palo Alto.
Oh, I see.
And he wanted me to become a department head in that organization.
Okay.
He said, you've had enough fun in Europe, why don't you come back now?
Okay.
Well, you know how the semiconductor industry works. When you want to come back, you never can. But when somebody invites you to come back, you better take you better jump at it.
Okay.
So he came back and together and I joined him and we started the materials and processes division at Fairchild R&D in Palo Alto.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon was the R&D director in that same building.
So you were in Italy from starting in 1961. Until
64.
61 to 64.
Physical presence in Italy.
Okay.
Almost 65.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And 64. Physical presence.
Right.
Then after that, I was based back in the R&D, but I went back and forth in administrating the Fairchild licenses
okay.
with Italy
okay.
and judging the viability of the other operations.
Mm-hmm.
That they were trying to set up.
Mm-hmm. So that was from 64 to 67?
To 67, right.
I see. And were you about half your time in California? And
yeah,
half?
About that would be about it. A lot of traveling.
Wow.
It was kind of fun, but it was heavy.
Mm. And
this was before the Fairchild guys left to form Intel.
Right.
But it was, I guess, Last and Ernie had left in 61, isn't that right?
Yeah, they left early.
What?
They went to Amelco.
Right. How did that impact you or the place?
Not too much. They had sort of kind of not, I wouldn't say outlived their usefulness, but they had kind of withdrawn from the operation. John had already got the two patents, the patent.
Right.
And Jay Last was, the step and repeat camera work had been all developed already by Bob Noyce and company. And he was getting itchy foot too.
Okay.
So they left to form a duplicate operation for Fairchild at Amelco. They didn't last there very long. In fact, Jean Dernier unfortunately took a bath in that one. He got into a lousy financial deal that really cost him a lot of money. He just was so anxious to leave, he didn't care to specify conditions. Okay. He just wanted to get out. It's a pity because he could have done it very well, conceivably done it very well, but it didn't work out.
So when Gordon Moore got in touch with you about really wanting you to come back full-time to R&D, was it specifically to set up this materials and processes?
Yes, specifically.
Okay.
I took over a group. That at that time was called Materials and Process, but it was run by kind of a lame brain from Shell Development, by the way.
Oh, I see.
He was from Gordon Waring, and he was having trouble with it. And Gordon said, I want you to take on these other engineers and form a full-fledged Materials and Processes group. And one of the missions, one of the main missions that I had a hell of a time trying to implement, and that's one of the weaknesses of our own approach in this country, is to convince PhD engineers that the problems on the manufacturing line were serious enough to warrant the best technical effort that you could find. And they just didn't want to do it. They just didn't want to. They were just, oh, hell, let them, they created the soup, let them get themselves out of it. And of course, we knew who knew processing already. Besides me, I also had two, three guys that were really good at processing that we had hired in R&D, in materials and processes. And I used to argue with those guys, get over there and get them out of the soup. It'll show up in your merit raise for sure. And you'll have the satisfaction of salvaging the line, but it was an awfully hard job to do. Just didn't want to do it, and that's a fault of chemists in the production line. Because if a chemist is really a chemist, what does he know about the yield of a device on production? What does he know of the deficiency of device performance? He doesn't have to be an electrical test engineer, but he has to understand the results. And you have to be able to go in and say to somebody, this is not Chernihiv, this is Chernigov. And just do it that way. Because we have a lot of data that show that that's correct. It's a hard thing to turn an R&D guy back into a production man. He doesn't see the immediate value. First, he can't publish. That's one thing. Secondly, what does he have to do to claim that he has created an improvement? It usually has to be some sort of specific problem solved or a yield increase in the device. Those are not easy to come by. Yeah. You have to have patience in order to do that.
Is it also a matter of social status?
It is also social status. They got into this mess, let them get themselves out of it. Yeah, but they're part of your company. No, they're not. They're in manufacturing. I can't tolerate a guy I remember who came back one time. He said, you know what he's doing in linear integrated circuits? He's he's marking wafers so he'll know which are the good ones and which are the bad ones, would start in the line. I said, well, what's wrong with that? It's a good idea, it seems to me. He says, yeah, but he's painting them green and red. And he got the paint from Sears Roebuck. And he went into the line, and half the runs that he wanted to test, he painted red, and the other half he painted green.
That's
crazy. And, you know, it's idiotic.
Absolutely. I mean,
the guy's off his rocker.
Absolutely.
I mean, you don't go in and poison wafers.
Absolutely.
Just to... Uh-huh. And these were, by this time, these were big ones. You know, mm-hmm. These were costly wafers.
Uh-huh.
But that was the caliber of some of the engineering work, and you had to have guys who could recognize that and say, look, oh, okay. Just don't do it right away. Just take the wafer, cut it in half, mm-hmm. Don't mark it, run one half on one day and the other half on the other day.
Mm-hmm.
It's awfully hard to get the process of PhDs. I'll get to that. I mean, I'll confine it to that. PhD process engineers to act as chemists or physicists or wherever they want to act at, mm-hmm. to go into the production line and solve the problem that they have.
Yeah.
It's a tremendously it's a tremendous source of personal satisfaction and cost saving when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But they just resist. Huh. And to this day, you have that kind of a problem in production,
yeah.
Problems. You have the interference into what you're doing by somebody with higher technical knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, doesn't help if somebody goes in and says, "Tell me what you're doing, and I'll tell you how to do it better." That's not a way to start a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the general mandate or function of that division? Was it, you know, obviously to solve these problems of the type we were just discussing, but was it to...
Of the R&D division?
Well, specifically the materials and processes.
To develop new materials and new processes for production.
Hmm.
It's just that simple. Not devices. We weren't asked to design devices. That was the function of the... design engineering group, mm-hmm. in another
mm-hmm.
area.
Mm-hmm.
That called for a mask design, that called for electrical engineering design work.
Mm-hmm.
We were asked to go in and solve the problem, improve the process, and increase the yield.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why are they turning out rejects?
Mm-hmm.
And so what sorts of activity did you initiate then?
Well, first I went over there myself with the full weight of my heavy position.
Thank you.
And find out, together with the engineers involved or the PhDs involved, and find out what the problem was.
Mm-hmm.
Just define the problem. Where is, what's happening at this stage, at this stage, at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
That took a lot of guts, you know, just to get the guys to admit something was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would assign a particular PhD as a troubleshooting engineer, and he would do what we called split runs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a self-explanatory term. When they started a batch of 20 wafers to the product line, he would take 10 of them,
mm-hmm.
cut them in half,
mm-hmm.
and 10 he'd put through the existing process,
mm-hmm.
and the other 10 he put through on what he thought to be the improvement.
Okay. Okay.
And look at the difference when it comes out of the line. Split runs was the magic word.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you could do some instrumental examination along the way. You could, you know, test the test devices on the wafer and so forth. But split runs was the magic key toward solving it, and on top of that was the patience of working with somebody who didn't know
mm-hmm.
what it is you wanted to find out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So you had to explain that if somebody got a zero yield on a split run,
mm-hmm.
that it wasn't necessarily bad. All it was a zero compared to the other one that you're using in the same one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you might have made it bad on purpose in order to see if the effect was real. Hard, very hard job for a process engineer to do.
So what were the kind of processes you were working on in the
This would be diffusion process, metallization. Mostly the process were masking problems.
The mask sets had defects.
And they were getting, the defects were getting through to devices being made. And of course, a steady diet of testing problems. And you'd find, you could find out step by step in which step the various devices were disappearing. Rejects. Then of course, at the same time when you found that, you took them for analysis through the electron microscope analysis. You took them through the magnetochemistry analysis. All of this kind of thing that that you had to scan them with. Now, of course, there were some interesting events that occurred during all of this kind of work. I'll digress enough to, let me get a glass of water. Anybody for water?
No, I'm fine, thanks.